and welcome to Season 3, Episode 20 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Drs. Justin Winzenberg and Stephen Jones. In this podcast, we look to explore truth, beauty, wisdom, and goodness at the intersection of faith and scholarship. In today's episode, professor and filmmaker Jonathan Vinson joins us to continue the discussion of art and beauty. In part two of our conversation, Jonathan wrestles with why Christian art sometimes fails to tell good stories. But first, our highlights, lowlights, and insights for the week. So have you had any good coffee recently?
Had good coffee. No.
No. Oh, that's sad.
Well, I'm easy to please when it comes to coffee. Sure. I don't get picky. I love good coffee. I love mediocre coffee. So when I was in a conference recently here in Denver, which I'll talk a little bit more about, you get the highlights, the lights, and insights. I did have coffee there, but I stopped at the place that was the spot on the way that was just the only place. It wasn't great coffee. It wasn't terrible coffee, but it did the trick. And it was just fine. But when I would get to the convention center where a lot of the main events were being held, mm-hmm. there was a huge line at the coffee shop there. And the same coffee company, a spot about two blocks away where nobody was waiting in line. So I'd stop there instead.
Yeah.
It wasn't fantastic. It wasn't bad. Gotcha. How about you?
Yeah. I made bad coffee the other day for our little Thanksgiving party, but so that was not the goal.
Why was it bad?
It was bad because it was one of those things where there were grounds that had been in the office for who knows how long, and that's mm-hmm. what was available. Oh, yeah. So yeah,
been there.
So I put it. You know, do you ever put a little salt on your grounds when you do filter coffee?
No, I don't. Although I did recently hear about something about an egg. Have you heard about this?
No, I haven't heard about that.
Oh, we'll have to Google it.
So what's a highlight pen for you this week?
Well, I think it's a similar highlight that I had last time, but a little different in that I was able to attend another conference over the last week or so. So I had an opportunity to go to the Society of Biblical Literature and American Academy of Religion annual conference, which is in Denver this year. It's for biblical studies and religious studies. Yeah, so I had an opportunity to see a former student of ours and got to chat with her for quite a while, and a friend of hers who she was with. I had an opportunity to connect with some colleagues who I've known from the past PhD work. And the highlight though, in all of it, because it's a bit of an odd conference in that these sessions are 100% people reading their papers.
Okay. So I've been to a couple like that where they've written the paper and there's no panache, right? It's like, you're just there reading the paper, right?
Yeah. In fact, it's almost pointless because I could just sit and read the paper.
Do you get to ask questions afterwards?
I could read their paper. Yeah. Okay. So that's the benefit, is you get to ask questions afterwards, but an answer time is usually about 10 minutes at most. So you get these series of papers that are around some topic that the session is hosting, and they've got all these sessions going on at the same time. So here's a highlight though. Most of the time papers are being read. I discovered though, and I don't know why this just dawned on me for the first time, that the best sessions to go to are ones where they do book reviews.
Oh, sure.
So they'll have a person's book who came out, and they'll have all these, you know, oftentimes big name scholars who will review their work in front of them, and they'll carry on sort of conversation. Now, oftentimes the reviews are read and then the response is read, but then there's conversation happening between them afterward. Mm. It is the most in-depth engagement that you will get. But what was so encouraging to me about it, why it was a highlight for me, is there's this one session I was in, and this person's book has just come out within the last year. They had these big name scholars reviewing it, and most of them had some pretty substantial critiques of this person's work, but the graciousness with which these scholars critiqued this person's work, mm. I think was academia at its best. Nice. I mean, it really was. It's like, if there's anything that academia can do well, when we're doing it well, is this kind of thing where it gives you an opportunity to show some pretty substantial disagreement on a subject, but with a lot of generosity.
Yeah.
And a lot of respect. And so none of the people were like, oh, this work is garbage, but all of them had some pretty substantial critiques. Mm. And then the person replied afterwards with some sense of, you know, I think you maybe misunderstood this part, or I could have done this better. It was about the best presentation I've ever seen at an academic conference.
Nice.
So it was fantastic. It was encouraging because I think it shows that when academia is doing well, that this was kind of one of those shining examples of generosity in critique. If there's anything I could take from it, it was to show a similar amount of generosity in my own critiques of other people's works, both within the classroom and outside of mm-hmm. it. So how about for you? What was a highlight for you?
I think a highlight for me, I had a few. One was the Christmas markets are open here now in Mullen.
Oh, nice.
And so I've been to a couple now. Jenny joined a neighborhood choir and got to sing at what was the Gendarmenmarkt Christmas market, but it was held in Babelplatz, which is where the book burning was right next to the
wow.
opera house. And yeah, just really, I don't know, that was fun. It was something that when we moved here, I didn't expect, you know, and yeah, it was just cool for her to get to do that and to get to be part of that. And yeah, so that's definitely part of it. We also just celebrated Thanksgiving a couple days late here. It's not a holiday. So Thanksgiving was a work day mm-hmm. for us, both Thursday and Friday and Wednesday. You know, I was missing that. but yeah.
We're talking academic calendar now. We usually get 3 days off for that week.
And yeah, that definitely didn't happen, but it was nice. We had, I think, 23 people or so in our new space next door here celebrating mm-hmm. Thanksgiving together at a nice big meal. And that was a lot of fun.
That's great. What was the low light for you?
Well, I think the low light was, you know, this was our second Thanksgiving here. And I think the disconnect that we felt from all of the Thanksgiving things back in the US felt much more profound this year. I think the first year it just felt weird. It was like, oh, we're doing school and work on Thanksgiving and that feels strange. And this year was like, oh, I really miss I miss that time of year. And part of it, like I would always smoke a turkey on the grill and I miss doing that. And, you know, some of that kind of the pivot to Christmas that happens after Thanksgiving and yeah. And of course being with family and friends and yeah. So I think we felt further away this year. And so that was a low light.
Yeah. That's gotta be tricky. I think the further or the longer that you're away, right. Is mm-hmm. there's these substantial holidays that you're used to getting together with family that you end up missing out on. And I think you hinted at that maybe a few weeks ago mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah.
And just some of, I can understand how that feeling I think could be, it could be a bit jarring, especially the longer that you're away.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was interesting. I somehow had thought the first year would be harder than this year, but it wasn't. So how about for you? What's a low light?
I feel like I've mentioned this kind of thing before, so I'll keep it brief because it'll sound like I'm complaining where I probably shouldn't be. But we're in this weird phase of the academic calendar where you get back from this wonderful break. And actually for me, it's been odd because I missed last Friday, I'm sorry, two Fridays ago and the following Monday because I was away at conference. Oh, so sure. Then I come back for a day. I teach class and then I have 5 days off.
Wow.
For Thanksgiving.
Yeah, that's great.
3-day work week and then the 2-day weekend. So a lot of students I think maybe start to feel this is the most wonderful time of the year. I could say that it's not. Because I think most everyone's feeling the sense that some pretty substantial projects are due around these times because we're kind of winding down the end of the semester. So I think of out of all the things in the academic calendar that can be most stressful times, it's the ends of these semesters.
Yeah.
That sort of 2 weeks leading up to the end that can be quite stressful. I've got stuff piled up now.
I mean, I think as a prof, it's like the week before classes start and then the 2 weeks at the end, right?
Yep. No, you're right. Yeah. That's brilliant. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, there's this weird time in February in Minnesota where, you know, you're not the end of a semester, not at the beginning, but it's just February and everybody's just
it feels like it's February for a long time, right? Even though it's a short month.
Oh, it feels like, yeah, it feels like February forever. You know, and then March comes around and you hit spring break. Mm-hmm. So that's like the refresher.
Right.
But it's a little bit odd because we have this break and then we have 2 weeks or so, two and a half, 3 weeks, and then we're done. So it kind of feels like, ooh, we're getting close to the end, but things are piling up. Students are feeling it. Mm-hmm. That's why I was joking, saying that they think it's the most wonderful time of the year. Cause I don't think they do.
So much pressure, right? It's just like,
yeah,
the run up to the end.
It's our fault too, right? Because we've scheduled these things, but I find myself,
I mean,
continually.
Yes and no, right? Like there's a word in German that's Jein. It's a combination of ja and nein. Jein, you know, it's, yeah.
Jein.
Is it the prof's fault? Yeah. I mean, usually
at least those big projects were scheduled way in advance, right? And there was opportunity to work on them in way in advance. That's not always true with tests and things. Yeah. If, you know, if you're doing chapter tests or whatever. Yeah. And I think
this is the bummer, is it's easy to have the most substantial projects due at the end of the semester, which means it's heavy for students. It's happening in multiple classes for them. And it's heavy for us because then we have to do that grading and get them back to them before the end of the semester. But it's hard to do that earlier in the semester because you haven't worked through process that you need to be able to do that project. So it's a lose-lose because pros don't love it. They don't love having to grade that kind of with a week or two to go in the semester, and students don't love having to write it then.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure there's a better way. There's got to be a better way,
I sometimes I would have classes where there was a big project due in the middle of the class, and then there would be an opportunity for a rewrite. That was probably my favorite.
Yeah.
But that required me to have space in the middle of the class. And when I was working on the doctorate, I just didn't, you know. And so I was like, I can't grade these same things twice when I was doing that.
Yeah, I totally get it. Totally get it.
But that 100% was my favorite way with big projects, was to have it actually do about 8 weeks in and then have 10 weeks or 8 weeks of revision available. So what's an insight for you?
Well, maybe if I retread back for a moment on this reflection on academic conference, I was thinking as I saw this, book review, and that sort of generous critique being offered, that I wish what we did there, and it doesn't happen all the time in academia whatsoever. I've heard horror stories on Twitter of scholars and early career scholars who did not have that experience at conferences where they were, you know, ripped into by a senior scholar for some point of minutia in their paper. So that's not always the case. But when we are doing that well, I wish there was a way to be able to transfer that kind of sentiment, to teach that kind of sentiment in some ways to not only our students, but to other fields. and I'm not meaning biblical studies to other fields, but I don't get that sense, like in politics, that's all that common. I think one of the weaknesses in American politics in particular is this complete inability to acknowledge that your opponent has some really good things going. And I think that's what I saw happening at this conference. Again, not to suggest that biblical studies academia is doing it the best, but why can't we have more of that sentiment in other areas of society where we can deeply disagree, but have a lot of respect for our opponents and have a lot of respect for their views, to do both criticism, but generously, and acknowledgement of their benefits or the positives that they bring to the table. So there's something about public discourse, both in social media and not just within the realm of politics, but just in general, where this kind of generosity isn't often expressed. What's an insight for you?
So last night was the first Sunday of Advent, and thinking about hope, I just, you know, I've been reflecting some about hope and doing a little bit of reading and some writing and the blog on Patreon. But I think there's just something about Advent and hope and lament that just really connects for me. We watched the Bible Project video on hope last night, and talking about hope as both expectation, but also as kind of this tension of like this something being pulled on, so hope as, I think we often think of hope in kind of this very positive, you know, kind of optimistic kind of a way. And the way that they were describing hope in the video fit much more with the way that I feel about hope, which is that sometimes hope is even unpleasant, right? It's like, I look at the world around me and I'm like, I don't want it to be the way it is. And in that way, it reminds me of lament. And there's this hope that it's going to get better, this agreement that it should be better. Attaching that ultimately to a person. So I think we'll maybe do a whole episode talking about some of those themes, but yeah, that's something that I've been, I don't know, just processing, resonating with, is, you know, what does it look like to live with hope? And I think particularly, like we're doing this book project, a Ukrainian woman who's in Ukraine with the war going on there, and just feeling so much of it shouldn't be like this, right? And so what does hope look like? And I think there's a kind of a cheap approach to hope that is maybe dismissive of the problems of the day. And I think the more costly hope is something that I find a lot of resonance with. So
Yeah, maybe even often an escapist sort of hope sometimes within Christian circles, yeah. Right? Yeah, this will be. I think it'll be important for us to reflect on this a little bit. Maybe we'll have a chance in a separate episode here over the next several weeks to leading up to Christmas, maybe to do more on that.
Yeah, that sounds good.
We'll be back in a moment with professor and filmmaker Jonathan Vinson. As with the first conversation with Jonathan, I do want to apologize for some anomalies in the audio files. We experienced a power outage in the middle of recording and had to piece together some of the conversation. I think it turned out all right, but some of the sound quality is less than what we usually try to achieve. In part one of the conversation, Jonathan introduced the idea of a Christological foundation for understanding beauty.
For me, Christology is one of the places that I actually go to probably most. That's for a number of reasons. I think beauty and art speak to the nature of God in many different genres and many different forms. And I think Christ's journey in Christology is such a beautiful intersection between all of that, right? Because the story of Christ is so compelling.
And now here's our conversation with Jonathan Vinson.
So I don't want to throw you underneath the bus here, but something that you and I both talk about quite a bit in our faith and film class is our revulsion to certain forms of Christian filmmaking. So do you think then the things that have led to your being critical of certain forms of Christian art, like Christian films, mm-hmm. do you think that's because it tries too hard to make a true statement at the cost of an aesthetic? Or do you think that it only cares about an aesthetic and not about the truth claims? Or is there something more to it than mm-hmm. that?
So yeah, talking about Christian film, let's talk about Christian film, shall we? Or what we define as Christian film in some of our conversations. You know, and I think the overall pursuit is so, I think, actually important and valuable. You know, I look back, my father actually came to faith through a Billy Graham film. That he watched. And that was a huge part of his journey. I do think there's a lot of unfortunate pitfalls that we run into in the world, especially of Christian film. And I would say Christian art in general. And it's not because, spoiler alert, it's not because we're working too hard on the aesthetic. It's because we're not paying enough attention to the aesthetic. And to be honest, that really gets my blood boiling a little bit, right? Because if we have the greatest story of all, we should be working really hard to be the greatest storytellers that we can be and to tell that story in, as best I can and do it justice. And there are a few things I think in good storytelling and in good art that you have to pay attention to. There are a few hangups I think sometimes within the evangelical community that create obstacles for us as we're pursuing good art, right? And so one of those is the fact in the evangelical community that the message, right, for us is super important. And there's actually some big correlations between theme and message. Although I don't like the word message when we're talking about art, and that could be a whole other conversation why I think that word is problematic. But I think what happens a lot of times in the evangelical community is like, okay, we have this amazing message, right? We have this amazing story available to us. But unfortunately, once we start to, we start with that. We lead with that. And one of my professors in my MFA program, her name's Andrea Nosfell. I think she's actually teaching now at USC in their film school. One time she looked at us, she said, never start with theme. And then I began to look at it and I was like, that's all we've been doing in the Christian film world is that we start, you know, say, okay, here's our message, here's our theme. And we're going to put something around that to make that happen. And right. And I think part of the anxieties around that is that we have to get, the theme has to be crystal clear.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the biggest pitfalls is that theme when done well through storytelling is not in your face. It is very subtle actually. And it's this kind of conclusion that the audience organically comes to when they've been taken on the journey of a well-crafted plot. And unfortunately, sometimes we are so concerned about the message. You know, again, not to say that the message isn't important, it's just an order of operations thing. You know, we need to start with an incredible story, an incredible plot, and then we need to see, okay, what what organically comes out of that plot. And it's when we try to force a theme kind of on top of that, that things just fall apart. So there's this, it was floating around Twitter a while ago, but there was this movie called The World Enslaved by a Virus 2020 mm-hmm. or something like that. Did you guys hear about that at all?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I heard about it through you.
It was made in Germany, I think, Stephen. It's a terrible movie. It's just really, really poorly done. But I think, man, as you look at the film, there's this one scene where they just tack on the gospel message and it really doesn't fit within the, it doesn't really fit within the overall narrative super well. And so, and that's one of those instances where we're not looking at what the plot has for us or what the story has for us and what themes can organically come out of it. We're just tacking something on there. So
I found, yeah, I'm really sympathetic to what you're saying, as you well know, but I'll let our listeners know, because I find myself often when I drive in to work, I'm just listening to music and whatnot or a podcast. But when I'm listening to music, I had this thought the other day. It's not a particularly new thought, but it just resonated with me for some reason more now than more recently. And that is, I'm listening to Bon Iver, or I even think about the new Taylor Swift album that came out. I think of artists like them. I mean, songwriters. I think of Billie Holiday and others, just historically speaking. And I'm like, and then I think about Christian music, and I think about the music that we play in our chapels and we play in our churches. And I revolt sometimes against the Christian music we have. I'm like, where are our Bon Ivers? Where are our Taylor Swifts? Where are our Billie Holidays? Like, where are the people who can write? Like, write. Because it seems like the same thing is happening in Christian music, where there's this sense of like, you just have to say quite explicitly what you're trying to say, which I actually find to be a little ironic, because if you really think about a lot of our Christian songs, like worship songs, they're not really all that explicit because they're so heavy in jargonization. We use big theological words like righteousness, you know, it's interesting because when I get students in my Romans class and we start to unpack what some of those words mean, often students can't really express what they mean, even though they're singing them in their worship songs all the time.
Yeah.
And it's like, I heard somebody recently on Twitter hail one of the more recent, Christian artists who were writing all the worship songs, is like, oh no, this is like the best Christian songwriter. And I won't name the person, but my initial thought was, if this is the best we have, we're in trouble, because I just think that there's too much simplicity in some of our Christian music. There's no poetry. Our listeners are going to say, man, Winsenberg's really off on a rant here, but I'm sympathizing with you, because I think the same thing is the problem with Christian music.
I have a question about that.
Yeah. Though. Okay. Go.
Do you think, I'm wondering, is the issue fundamentally in a lack of commitment to the art of the storytelling, or is there another issue, for example, an underdeveloped theology of suffering? Like, I feel like one of the things that for me, something that has been really difficult for me with certain expressions of Christian music and Christian art, is that there seems to be an inability to sit with tension and an inability to sit with pain and an inability to sit with suffering, and this too quick resolution. And I wonder, is that primarily an issue with storytelling, or is that actually a theological or even discipleship type of a shortcoming?
Yeah. Man, I want to speak to both of those, because I resonate with both of what you guys are saying. Yeah. I think, again, a part of what we may be seeing, and I resonate a lot of with you, Justin, especially on the frustration around music, right? And I think we, especially in the evangelical Christian community, have not maybe been as committed as we could be to the craft, to the art form, and thinking about that. And again, part of that, I think, has to deal with some anxieties around the message, making sure that it's crystal clear when we are ironically focusing so much on the message that we actually, when we negate or neglect rather the art form, we're doing great damage to the message. I think we fail to see that. You know, there was one of those artists that I mentioned actually earlier, I think the lead singer from the band Copeland. I think he's a Christian. I'm not 100% sure where he's maybe at in his faith journey anymore, but he literally would play this game with the band where they would say like, okay, let's find, they would be in a new city and they would surf between channels, and then, and whoever would be able to name whether or not it was a Christian music channel first won.
Which is an easy task, actually. Yeah, just by the very sound of the music, you can often tell.
Yes. And that's actually, that's how they would tell it oftentimes, is the mix of the lyrics to the rest of the music. It's always super, super hot in the mix. Mm-hmm. Whereas in other, you know, music forms, you don't hear that. And where does that stem from? Probably. Well, you know, again, the words are what's important.
That is so interesting. The evangelical
community, when we maybe fail to realize, hey, maybe they need to listen to the song like more than once. But if we actually don't put the lyrics as hot in the mix, hey, maybe the song would be more effective or sound better when we let the instruments, you know, take their part, so to speak. So yeah, I think there are some things in neglect that we have in the craft. And I think some opportunities to put forth better artists there too. And Stephen, I'll speak to what you were saying about, I think, you know, why are we maybe seeing some of what we're seeing there? And I think, actually, can you I want to make sure I do your question justice. Can you recap your question really quick, Stephen? That you had?
Yeah, I think specifically the question of, do you think that there is perhaps as much a theological shortcoming as particularly around suffering and tension beyond, you know, the artistic shortcoming?
Yeah, exactly. And I think there are two things there that I want to speak to. I think there's a theological shortcoming, and I think there are some philosophical hangups that we're encountering there, right? And I think part of it too goes to questions about epistemology, right? I think if we allow ourselves to embrace a more narrative epistemology, when we encounter things that, you know, maybe conflict with one another, right? We're able to sit in that tension more. I think there can be this impulse within the evangelical community that when we encounter things that questions that are hard, we just ignore them or change the subject or think about something else or throw our hands up in the air. When in actuality, we need to sit with those things more. And I think, quote unquote, a more narrative epistemology helps us to encounter those things on a much deeper level and to actually grounds it in reality, right? Like, I think that's the power of again, that Christology that we're talking about earlier. When we're able to actually sit with the Christological journey and narrative, that allows us to encounter very tough questions and see, okay, how did Christ deal with this? Were these questions necessarily resolved in a conversation or in a quipped answer, or was it answered in something else, right? So I think doing the theological, and again, I mean, you could definitely go back and look at a lot of CCM or contemporary Christian music, right? And I see a rather underdeveloped, let's say, theology. I think that's something that we sometimes encounter there, right?
Yeah, with a few exceptions, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. Again, there are most definitely exceptions. You know, Justin and I talk, I grew up with Rich Mullins, right? And Justin, you grew up with him too. You encountered him later, I guess.
Yeah.
And I think he was able to do some of that work. And even like guys like Steve Green from like the olden days.
Yeah.
Was able to do some of that, but
Rich Mullins, Jacob and Two Women. I mean, there's just not a song like that that would be written now by Christians. Mm-hmm. Jacob, he loved Rachel. Rachel, she loved him, and Leah was just there for dramatic effect. Yeah, it's right there in the Bible, so it must not be a sin, but it sure does seem like an awful dirty trick. You know, like it's just, there's this craft to it. I wonder, this is interesting now philosophically what you're talking about. I wonder sometimes if both in Christian film, especially when it comes to Jesus films, and in Christian songwriting, if the positivism shows itself in this obsessive need to stick to the words of scripture. And I'm using air quotes there. Wait, what? I'm using air quotes because, in other words, like in the Jesus films, we want Jesus to say the words that the scriptures say. In our Christian, you know, worship songs, we want to use the words of scriptures. There's nothing, I think, inherently wrong with that. There's a little irony because none of those are the words of scripture.
Right,
because
they're translated.
As I remind my students, because all of those words are in English, okay? And you know, and I'm maybe being a little bit overboard on that, but I wonder actually if that, it's not just that we have this high view of scripture. scripture that we no, these are what matter the most, but it's also rooted in a sort of positivism where it's fundamentally on the level of these words, right? We don't feel comfortable reshaping the words poetically in either Christian film or in Christian songwriting, like a Rich Mullins might, or even like Sufjan Stevens. I can't see a modern Christian artist writing "Oh God, Where Are You Now" on Sufjan Stevens. I think it was on his Michigan album, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and actually he uses quite a bit of like Christian lingo in there, but he does it in a way that's very not like what we would encounter in a chapel service.
Yeah.
So what do you think about that in terms of, is this actually a remnant of positivism that we feel this obsessive need to stick to just what we think are the scriptural words, or is it just a lack of creativity?
It's probably a little bit of both. I think we do encounter, you know, a lack of creativity sometimes. And again, I'm using generalizations. I'm not saying that there are no talented Christian musicians or worship artists out there by any stretch of the imagination. And I think there is a time and place, right, for like some of these anthemic, like beautiful worship songs that, you know, speak back to God, how incredible and beautiful God is, right? But at the same time, there are psalms, I think there's at least one psalm, I don't have it off the top of my head, that doesn't resolve the tension. It's, you know, there are the psalms of lament, and some of them
resolve several of them.
Especially Psalm 137.
Yeah,
like where I guess if there is a resolution, it's the dashing of the enemy's children's heads against the rocks, which isn't exactly resolution.
Like it's not tied up with a bow, you know?
No.
And I'm like, where are those narratives? Like, where are those songs for us? Yeah. Right. And I think, like, you think about that song from Sufjan Stevens, right? Like, that's maybe the closest thing that we have. Right.
Yeah.
And I think there can be this remnant, right, of positivism that needs to end with an answer.
Yeah.
And I think that's maybe why we've ended up where we have with that, so to speak.
I wonder too. Yeah. I don't know if this is going too far afield, but there's also an eschatological issue there. I have heard, I have not verified it myself, so I'd be interested, you know, if either of you finds out more about this, to know more about it. But I have heard that American hymnals used to have hymns and even the Psalms of lament in them. And then as a response to what at the time was a post-millennial eschatology, there was that those things were removed, right? Because this idea was we were achieving the millennium essentially. And so we should not have any more tears. And so let's get rid of those things. And so then they're gone out of the hymnals. I it would be fascinating to actually verify that. But what I heard was this was like in the mid to late 1800s that happened. And so it's funny because now we're in this premillennial, you know, this whole debate, Justin, you referenced in the podcast before this, you know, some of these theological questions of how much should we be formed by premillennialism or other things. But anyway, we have apparently deprived ourselves now for generations of some of these expressions of faith that expect suffering and expect sadness and expect the lack of resolution. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I think for me, what art, one of the most beautiful things that art does, if I can try to, you know, use the adjective interpretation of your idea of what beauty is that it elicits from me a response around this idea or speaks a truth around the idea of suffering. I think some of the music in particular that I have found most beautiful has been the music, like I found an album of lament and it's songs of lament. And I particularly around Christmas, it's like food for my soul because it speaks to this reality of longing and this reality of things aren't the way they're supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And so it speaks this truth that I feel like is largely missing for me. Anyway, long thought there, but is it this eschatological thing? Did we steal from ourselves in an attempt to, you know, make some eschatological reality present in a way that was premature.
Yeah.
I don't know that I'm asking you that. I don't know that you're prepared to answer that, but I, yeah.
No, I think that that is so fascinating. And I love to like going on this conversation about like Psalms of Lament and needing those. One of the things that I'm planning on talking about with my class is, so all, in certain conversations that we have in the world of communication, we sometimes talk about the prophet and the priest and those roles that can that media can function in society. And we're kind of comfortable having conversations around that too, even in regards to ministry, right? Some of us tend to have more of a prophetic voice and others a priestly voice. And a lot of times the priestly voice is conceived as reinforcing ideas that we already have, or, you know, kind of creating content or things that resonate with where people are. That's actually another way that I kind of conceive of it. Whereas, you know, the prophetic voice is challenging things that we see in the world or in the culture. And again, as we think through, I think it's important for us as we're thinking through Christian art, you know, that we see stuff that's both, right? I would say that I would argue that, especially in the Christian music world, we're seeing stuff that is mainly attempting to do the priestly stuff. Although I think some of the priestly work that we sometimes need is actually absent, right? Like the songs of lament, like, do we have good songs there? Like, I think there's a massive hole there. And then I think of voices like, again, Rich Mullins, right? Who I think had a powerful prophetic voice, whether in his music or just through his microphone on stage at times when he would get into his mini sermons, so to speak.
Say, I just thought up of an assignment for you for this beauty class.
Oh, really?
so take quote unquote secular artists who have nice poetic music and then get the students to rewrite them if it were Christian, using Christian lingo. Like what I mean is not making it Christianized, but I mean simplifying it into non-poetic language. And then give them a Christian song that's pretty straightforward, like not all that poetic, and then have them rewrite it into more poetic language. There you go.
That could be interesting. You'll have to,
Stephen, I'm wondering quickly just about this idea of eschatology and beauty that you tapped into. I wonder if we have this almost Platonic, meaning Plato, Platonic eschatology, where like the real is the afterlife and everything here is kind of just some, you know, faint expression of that. And if so, then it seems like maybe this could find its way into art, in meaning that on the one hand, I guess positively, it could mean that the artists are really trying to capture this sort of transcendent reality, and it could lead to more beauty. In other forms of Christian thinking, that maybe Platonic thought could almost make it seem like, well, the artistic component on this earth is, it doesn't matter because the real beauty is on the other side. I don't know. Is that a well-developed thought? But I wonder
I think sometimes there's this feeling that if we pay attention to the pain in the world, that we're somehow failing to pay attention to who God is. I just think the Christological response to that is so potent.
Yeah.
Right. The idea of Jesus, of finding beauty rooted in Christology, then the pain of the world is unavoidable. It's just front and center.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of people, when they're writing about beauty, intersect a lot with Thomas Aquinas. And, you know, there's some kind of traces you might say of that almost like Neoplatonic thought that you can find sometimes through those writings. And that's why, again, for me, Christology is such a powerful theological category to look at beauty through, and sometimes subversive, actually, when we look at, you know, other people and other writing, so to speak, on this, as we look at other people. So, yeah.
So I would be bad of us to talk about beauty without asking you who are some of your favorite artists.
Oh,
and why? Man,
yeah. And I guess the question is like, even like art forms.
Leave it open. You can decide which art forms.
Yeah.
Although you better talk about film. Okay. You're a filmmaker. Yeah. So if you don't talk about film, you did mention Wes Anderson already. So you could talk more about him more, but go ahead. I'll just leave it open for you. You can choose to answer.
For me, Wes Anderson is just an incredible seminal storyteller. And I think in so many ways, I think he's an incredible collaborator. And so I like, as, as a practitioner, I admire him so much and just how he, you know, a lot of times a director, you're walking a fine line between being collaborative and being something like a dictator on set. Mm. And I don't necessarily mean that in like a very negative sense, even, you know, for a director, you're trying to execute a vision, right? And it's actually really important for you to have clarity in that vision. But Wes Anderson does so well holding on to both. He's an incredible collaborator, and yet his commitment to his vision is absolutely unwavering. And that's how he's able to achieve such a consistent aesthetic, right? Mm-hmm. Is that he's just so committed to this particular vision. And I think part of it, right, is like this, he has this incredible way of being super explicit about what he's talking about, mm-hmm. but doing it in a way that is creative and unique and sometimes very quirky. Mm-hmm. That also somehow creates this subtlety to his work. And so this, again, that like duality, I think that attracts me to what he's able to do and accomplish. The other thing too is in terms of like other filmmakers that do, I think, amazing work. Guys like Rian Johnson, actually, he just creates these plots that are just so elaborate and, you know, surprising. And I think that is just so important in filmmaking, creating narratives that are surprising and that surprise you. So those are some things. In terms of musicians, Sufjan Stevens is one of my favorite artists. I think I mentioned him before. Mm-hmm. He's just, his writing is not only just so thoughtful and thought provoking, but he is honestly a composer in terms of like the work that he does. Like it's just marvelous in terms of what he's able to do with his work. So yeah, so those are some of the artists that I love.
Yeah, I've seen Sufjan Stevens live, and I mean he delivers in person in a way that I've never seen any Christian mm-hmm. performer do. And it makes me just think, right, when it comes to Christian art, and I mean I know Sufjan Stevens may identify as a Christian or whatnot. I don't know exact identification, but I always think, where are the Sufjan Stevens and where are the Wes Andersons in Christian filmmaking? And until there are Wes Andersons and Sufjan Stevens, I don't personally feel all that much of a draw towards things generally labeled as Christian art, or Christian, mean mostly evangelical, white evangelical Christian. Man, get us a Wes Anderson, right? Making films like that, and maybe we've got a different situation.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I don't think the series is perfect. I've only watched, you know, a little bit of it, but, you know, The Chosen, I think starting to make some headway there in terms of like looking at some good storytelling and telling Christ's story. And it's actually going back to that positivistic discussion, right, Justin? It's because mm-hmm. they've intentionally said, no, in order to do this series and do it well, we actually have to, we kind of have to fill in the gap, so to speak, in terms of what may have happened or what we think may have happened.
Or what we imagine could have happened, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Which, and actually that fits from a critical realist perspective, creativity being such an important part of knowing. It's interesting.
Exactly.
Epistemologically.
100%. And so I think as I think about that and look at, you know, their work and what they have done and what they're doing, I think a lot of that goes back to them saying like, okay, we're going to free ourselves up to do what the medium needs us to. And that's to make a lot of decisions about the world and the story world and what that would have maybe been and what that might've looked like and character development and actually developing characters, et cetera, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So as we wrap up here, first of all, I wish we had another 2 hours because we had other questions we didn't get to get into and some that I think would be really fun to develop more. So we'll have to have you back at some point. But I'm curious as you kind of look at the world around you and reflect on beauty in particular in it, where do you find hope?
That's a great question. Hope can be hard to come by these days if we're transparent, right? But I guess I see hope in the next generation of storytellers. You know, when I look at sometimes my students and some of the work that they're doing and some of the things that the next generation is paying attention to, I think a lot of times the next generation is able to come up with profound answers to issues raised by the previous generation that they seem to have none, you know, no answers for. So yeah, I don't know. I think that's what gives me hope, I guess, is looking at what I think God is doing in the next generation, a work that God is trying to stir up in them to again, create some answers for these things. And I hope, you know, as I look at my role and even looking at my son, you know, like I think more and more about the next generation and what kind of world they're going to inherit. And, you know, can we help them to think about some of these things and how story can help them think about these things in deeper and more profound ways, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Hey, thanks, Jonathan.
All right, we'll see you guys.
Catch you later.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. Reed Peters is a recognized patron of the show. As always, you can join us at patreon.com/profsinrooms for more conversation and bonus content. We hope you can join us for coffee again next time.